Happy holidays, cinephiles, and welcome to a very special re-release of a cinephile holiday classic, Miracle on 34th Street.
Yeah, this year Steve and I decided to do some new intros for each of the releases. We're going to keep them short, and we're going to keep them pretty standard. So if you've already heard this intro, in case you're listening out of order, we just want to tell you, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays. Thank you so much for supporting the Cinephiles for another year. And we love bringing you these episodes every year in terms of Christmas episodes. And we hope you're enjoying the ones we are bringing in with Holiday Inn and White Christmas.
And this one goes all the way back to 2017. So the movie reviews were not quite as long as they are today. But this still was a wonderful conversation about a true Christmas classic.
Yeah. So sit back, relax, put on some hot cocoa, I guess. Get some gingerbread cookies. And make sure you tug on that beard and find out if that's really Kris Kringle. And enjoy Miracle on 34th Street.
And if he is the person he believes himself to be, just as you are, then he's just as sane.
Granted, but he isn't.
Oh, but he is, Your Honor.
Is what?
I intend to prove that Mr. Kringle is Santa Claus.
Hello and welcome to The Cinephiles, where each week we enter the world of a great film. We explore its themes, the history, the filmmaking, and the influence it has on us today. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Roque. I'm a voiceover artist, host, producer, writer, all kinds of things here in California.
And today I've brought John to see my beautiful Christmas tree.
I'm sitting here in the living room looking at your Christmas tree, which is perfect for what we're going to talk about today. So it's putting me right in the right mood.
Because what we're going to talk about is Miracle on 34th Street. Yeah. It's our second Christmas film. We did It's a Wonderful Life already. Yeah. And It's a Wonderful Life is my favorite.
Right. Both of our favorites.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely, by far. Mm-hmm. And this, I think, is the other great classic Christmas film.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's
a strong statement
of the era, you know, okay, from back in the day. I mean,
some people argue White Christmas.
Or Holiday Inn.
Yeah, there are arguments.
Yeah, sure. You're saying that cinephiles have arguments about
I don't know if I could say what my second.
Well, I'm not saying it's the second. I don't know if it's my second favorite, but it is the second of the classic era to me.
Fair.
That's where I would put it.
Sure, absolutely.
You remember how you first came to it?
Yes, 3 hours ago.
What?
Yes, I watched it. I watched it for this episode of The Cinephiles. I've never seen the movie before.
Wow. How did you avoid it?
I don't know. I'd seen it in passing, like scenes or a couple of like on the guide, but I never clicked on it and watched it. So it wasn't something that I necessarily gravitated to. And I guess I'm just waiting for the excuse. I always say to myself, I'm going to watch it, and never quite find the mood. And I was kind of in the mood last year when I was going to watch it with someone I was dating, but it didn't quite get there. And to watch it for The Cinephiles, that's because I wasn't meant to watch it with that person. I was meant to watch it for The Cinephiles.
It's so great because I feel like one of the cool things about this show is in a lot of ways the movies we haven't seen are like a huge, it's kind of awesome.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because with me with like Judgment at Nuremberg, which I hadn't seen before, or you with Willy Wonka, like, oh, we get someone, because I'd seen it over and over again as a kid. Mm-hmm. I have no memory of the first time I saw it. I saw it every year, multiple times. And then I hadn't seen it again in like 15 years.
Right.
And I have another question for you before we get into it.
All right.
Did you believe in Santa?
Of course. Of course. Until I was like 8 or 9. I can't remember when the dream was broken, but like 8 or 9 is when I woke up from the dream of Santa Claus, sadly. And it was at school. Someone had said something and I was like, what? What? And
then was it just crushing?
Yeah, it was, because the kids kind of laughed at me for not knowing by that, because I guess they had all been exposed to it by that time, and I just didn't.
Well, this is this weird thing that we do to kids.
It's a coming of age moment, man.
It's like we go, here, believe in this thing, and we do all sorts of stuff with milk and cookies and write letters and talk about them, and then and then we all know, you know, that at some point the bottom is going to drop out. I really debated what to do in terms of Jax.
Oh, yeah, your son, yeah.
Yeah, and it was finally, because I was sort of like, I don't like lying to him.
Yeah.
And it was finally in a conversation with Hoover, who I've talked about on the show.
Yes.
Who's been my partner in the documentary. He's a brilliant guy, raised great kids, great dad. And he talks about his everything to his kids, even when they were little, talked about racism and terrorism and torture and just always honest with them. And so I went and asked his advice, assuming he would say, no, I don't lie to my kids. And he said, you got to do Santa. Santa's the best. Mm. So much fun. And the thing he said is, the best thing is that first you believe in Santa, Then you get to be Santa, right, because you get to go out and teach your kids about being charitable and giving to people that are needy.
Yeah.
And then you look like Santa, because eventually you get so old that you got to look like Santa. I was like, okay, that's pretty good advice.
Yeah.
For me, I am Jewish.
Yes. I think
this has come up on the show before, but I'm a Jewish guy who grew up celebrating Christmas. And it's from a certain generation of Reform Jews that really wanted to assimilate when they came to the United States. And so my parents grew up celebrating Christmas. My grandparents, I think, celebrated Christmas. So even though we went to temple and celebrated Jewish holidays, we had a Christmas tree and the whole thing. But I never really believed in Santa. I don't think. I mean, I don't can't remember for sure. But I have no... For me, it was just... I think my sister believed.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it was just like a fun pretend game that we all did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like make-believe.
Like make-believe. Yeah. So a little bit about pre-production.
Yes, sure.
It starts with this writer, Valentine Davies, and he, in 1944, was in a department store and just went, man, Christmas has become too commercial.
Wow.
Right?
In 1944.
In 1944. Can you imagine what he would think if he saw it today? And he told his friends...
I'd like to see him at his first Black Friday.
Oh, my God. he went to his friend, George Seaton, who's a writer, and he said, this is a great idea. They wrote the screenplay. The screenplay went to the great Daryl Zanuck.
Oh, wow.
One of the great producers of all time, who produced Grapes of Wrath and How Green Was My Valley and 12 O'Clock High and... all sorts of films. Right. And he said, this is great. And he said, let's produce it. And the person they really wanted to be in it was Maureen O'Hara. And Maureen O'Hara had come to the U.S. in the early 40s during World War II to be in Hunchback of Notre Dame with Charles Laughton. And she got trapped in the United States. She's from Ireland and she couldn't go back home because of the war. So for like 3 or 4 years, she was stuck in the U.S.
Yeah.
And finally, the war ends. She goes, oh, finally, I can go back to Ireland. She goes back to Ireland. She's there not very long, gets a letter saying, you have to come back to the U.S. to be in, it was going to be called The Big Heart at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, no way. I just got back home. And then she read the script. And she said, okay.
Actors, man, we're slaves to scripts.
Yeah.
If it's good,
you're
not on a good part. So when you find one, you jump it.
You jump at it.
Yeah.
So they shot it. And this sounds like it was one of those movies where it was lovely. Oh. And everyone liked each other. And it shows. It just feels that way on screen.
Absolutely.
Everyone's having a good time.
Mm-hmm.
You want to get into the movie?
Yes, let's do it.
We start following Kris Kringle down the street, Edmund Gwenn, who just played, you know, lots of parts. He's in Hitchcock films. He's just a studio player. He's perfect.
He's so perfect. So believable. Not an inauthentic moment on screen. And just immediately gives you the right vibe to carry you through the whole movie.
He's wonderful.
Yeah.
And the first thing he sees is a guy setting up a display in a window, and it is reindeer.
Yes.
And they're not arranged correctly.
According to Kris Kringle.
According to Kris Kringle, and he bangs on the window and gets the guy to talk to him, and he says,
you've got Cupid where Blitzen should be. And Dasher, should be on my right-hand side.
He should, huh?
Yes.
And the look he gets from this shopkeeper is... You're crazy.
Yeah, it's just like I was saying, it's just like the It's a Wonderful Life moment when the lighthouse keeper or whoever it was.
Yes,
and about Clarence,
the angels.
Yeah, and the angels. Clarence starts talking about angels, and he falls down on his chair and then runs out of the place. because everybody's crazy.
Well, and this is going to be the theme of the movie, is this guy crazy?
Right.
And everyone's certainly going to react to him like he's crazy, because believing you're Santa Claus in today's world, well, that's crazy.
Right.
This
is going to be important.
Yeah. We go to the Thanksgiving Day Parade, and there we meet Maureen O'Hara.
Mm-hmm.
She's great.
Yeah.
I love her.
Powerful, statuesque, but still warm.
Yeah.
Powerful, in charge, but still warm.
And she is organizing this parade, and she's obviously very competent, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
And Kris Kringle walks up and sees the Santa. This is not a good Santa.
Drunk Santa. Bad Santa.
He's drunk, bad Santa.
Yeah.
He helps him out with a whip, and he... is very, very disappointed with him. Finally calls Doris Walker, that's Maureen O'Hara, over and points her out. She's really upset. It's like, we got to get some coffee in him. And then it's like, no, that's not going to work. She turns to Kris Kringle. Do you have any experience playing Santa?
Yeah, right.
He's like, a little. And I love his line. I love his line where he says, Madam.
Madam, I am not in the habit of substituting for spurious Santa Clauses.
That's just a great line.
Mm-hmm.
But he does agree to do it.
Yes.
And she kind of, the parade starts and he's being Santa. Seems to be doing a good job.
He's great.
He's great Santa. And she heads out because she didn't really care about the parade.
Yeah, and that's a first glimpse into her perception of the holidays, her perception of this kind of celebration of the holidays, she does not need to see it. She's going home to her kid, take care of her child,
right,
and have Thanksgiving dinner with her child.
She gets home, her child's not there.
No.
Where is her child gone? Child
with a strange man across the hall.
Across the hall.
That apparently Maureen O'Hara has never met before and may have seen in passing in the hall or whatever, but he is next door.
This is where you
she
go.
She's next door, rather.
Things have changed in 70 years.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No.
Well, and his behavior.
Yeah.
Which he is, this is Fred Gailey, I think, is the character, and mm-hmm. the actor is John, just went out of my head.
Oh, yeah.
He's lovely and sweet.
Yes.
Except that his behavior, looking at it through today's eyes, majorly creepy.
Yeah, a little creepy.
Yeah.
I don't want to say majorly, because he is manipulating the situation to a degree, but only because he wants to meet this woman and he actually finds her attractive.
Yes.
He's not trying to seduce her to have sex with her. He actually wants to date her and get to know her.
Absolutely. Right. Well,
he is using the child.
But I must confess, it's part of a deep-dyed plot.
I'm fond of Susie. Very fond. But I also want to meet you. I read someplace that the surest way to meet the mother is to be kind to the child.
What a horrible trick.
It worked.
Oh, and we should say,
yeah,
Susan.
Yes.
Natalie Wood.
The lovely, amazing Natalie Wood.
Yeah.
I don't know if people are going to get mad at me, but this is one of my favorite performances of hers ever. She is so believable as a child who's smarter than her age. She's older than her age. You know, she doesn't want to buy into fairy tales. She pushes back at him when Gailey's talking about giants. She knows better. But because her mom, we find out her mom, Maureen O'Hara's character, has been raising her in this way to not believe in fairy tales, not believe in these stories of Prince Charmings, all this kind of stuff. Yeah. So
right, because he's trying to imagine with her,
right,
which is kind of what you do with a kid.
Yes.
You know, like, let's play some, and she's having none of it. She's like, there are no giants. That's not realistic.
He certainly is a giant, isn't he?
Not really. There are no giants, Mr. Gailey.
My mom hired that Santa Claus. He's better than last year's Santa Claus.
Right.
And Maureen O'Hara shows up. And this is a great moment where Susan goes,
Mother, I was thinking, we've got such a big turkey for dinner, and there are only two of us. Couldn't we invite Mr. Gailey? Couldn't we?
Well...
Oh, don't even think about it. I'll have a sandwich or something.
It's an awful big turkey.
That's not it, dear, but I'm sure Mr. Gailey has other plans.
No, he hasn't. Have you?
And puts Doris Maureen O'Hara on the spot a bit. And then Susan totally blows it and says,
Didn't I ask all right, Mr. Gailey?
Right.
And it's
right.
obvious that he put her up to asking him over for dinner.
Right.
Which, if he wasn't such a lovely, sweet guy, it would be kind of a creep move.
Yes. And this guy's great, too. He's fantastic.
He's great. Movie.
John Payne, I think, is...
John Payne.
Just the name, John Payne. And doing just a little bit of research for this, just because I was curious about the actors and the characters in the movie, he said, till his death, that this was his favorite film. And it said, because it is the most authentic he's ever gotten to be about his own personal views on the world in a character ever.
He's a fun, and
it's so obvious,
lovely lightness and the sincerity.
Yes,
throughout the whole
sincerity
film.
Is the thing. Yeah,
yeah. And she says, okay, yeah, you can come over for dinner.
Right.
And then she gets a call from the other guy who works at Macy's, whose name I've also forgotten.
okay.
But I see you have IMDb open.
I do.
Tell us who it is.
I don't know if I can. Julian. Is it Julian Schellhammer? Is that his name?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, he calls and says, this is the best Santa we've ever had. You got to hire him. And they say, okay. And
the guy in the bow ties we were talking to. Julian, yeah.
And then we go to Macy's, and they're in the locker room. And this was, by the way, really shot at Macy's in Herald Square in New York. There was some stuff like the actual where kids were lining up to sit on Santa's lap. That's in Hollywood.
Okay.
But there's tons of shots, and it was shot around Christmas time at Macy's in Herald Square, which is a busy, busy place to be.
Yes.
And we're in the locker room, and there's Kris Kringle, and he's talking to Alfred.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
Do you like Alfred?
I love Alfred. Alfred is so great because... he's just a regular guy,
totally.
And he completely believes, like, Kris Kringle is saying, very obviously, he is Santa Claus in certain interactions with Alfred, and in no way is Alfred going like, what, you're crazy, whatever. He just believes, because he's just a very nice guy who just wants to believe people and get to know people.
So, well, and Alfred says, you know, I play Santa at the Y.
Yes.
And I love Chris's line. Again, he says, why do you like impersonating me? Mm-hmm. Or something like that. And there's no speed bump at all. He just goes, oh, well, I like it for this reason. He doesn't go impersonating you.
No, right, exactly.
He just accepts it. And then in comes our Macy's representative who wants to give Chris some tips.
Yes.
For being a Santa. And he says, and the tips are, and so for Chris's reaction is sort of, oh, tips on how to be Santa. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And the tips, of course, are, here are the toys we need to sell more of. We have too many of them. So yeah. These are what to push. Oof. Chris is not like this.
No, and he says, this is why I stopped being Santa Claus, because...
We didn't say this is why I stopped. He says, this is why I'm thinking about maybe my time is over.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
That because of the commercialism.
Mm-hmm.
And Alfred has this great line. It's like, yeah, there are a lot of bad isms out there, but commercialism is the worst.
Right. He has this weird kind of union moment, right? Where he's talking about like commercialism. Yeah. Go back to the spirit of Santa Claus. And we got to go back to the spirit of Christmas and blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Yeah. And now it's time for Santa to be with the kids.
Yeah.
The first kid comes up and he wants a fire engine. And mom is like, no, we can't get it. They don't have it anywhere.
Yeah.
And that's Thelma Ritter, by the way.
Yeah. Where's she from?
Tons of stuff.
I've seen her in a million things.
I don't have anything off the top of my head.
Oh my God. She's so great.
Lots and lots of stuff. She's good. And this is her first movie.
What?
Yeah. This is her first movie. And Santa says, mom has kind of given him the hint.
Right.
I can't get that fire engine. They don't have it anywhere. No, really. And Santa says, well, I promise you'll get it. And she goes, hey, son, get out of the way for a second. And she says, are you an idiot?
Mommy needs to thank Santa in her own way.
Yeah.
Mama wants to thank Santa Claus, too. Say, listen, what's the matter with you? Don't you understand English? I tell you, Macy's ain't got any. Nobody's got any. I've been all over. My feet are killing me. Fine thing, promising the kid.
Now, you don't think I would have said that unless I'm sure, do you? You can get those fire engines at Schoenfeld's on Lexington Avenue. Only $8.50, a wonderful bargain.
And she's shocked. Schoenfeld's is another department mm-hmm. store. Completely shocked.
Macy, sending people to the store. Are you kidding me?
Well, the only important thing is to make the children happy. And whether Macy or somebody else sells a toy doesn't make any difference. Don't you feel that way?
Huh? Oh, me? Oh, yeah, sure. Only I didn't know Macy's did.
Well, as long as I'm here, they do.
And the Macy's guy hears this.
Julian
hears this, yeah. And Jess is like, what?
He does the great perplex, like fumbling, yeah. Or like, I can't do that.
And then the next moment, Thelma Ritter comes up and says, thank you so much. And yes. Basically says, I'm going to go to Schoenfeld's to get this fire engine. I was never much of a Macy's shopper, but from now on, all my shopping is going to be at Macy's.
Right.
That's a great little twist.
Yeah.
And he goes back to his office, and apparently six more women want to come thank him and say how great this new Macy's policy is of sending people.
And he's all stressed out about it. Instead of being happy, he's all stressed out because he's like, you like it, they like it, I may like it, but I don't know if Mr. Macy's going to like it.
Yeah. R.H. Macy, who, by the way, died in 1895 or something like so that, the founder of Macy. He was not around at this point. And here's an interesting thing
even
about this
better,
movie.
Even better, man. Even
so
better.
Macy's, this takes place at Macy's.
Yeah.
And it also has Gimbel's, which is Mr. Gimbel, the Gimbel brothers. That's was a real mm-hmm. department store in New York.
I've been to
that. They needed the permission of Macy's and Gimbel's to make this film.
Of course.
Macy's and Gimbel's refused to give permission until they saw the movie.
Oh, wow.
They made the whole movie
not
knowing if they would be able to release it because Macy's and Gimbel's had to say, okay, which is kind of terrifying.
Yeah.
Now, Fred Gailey, who has apparently been taking care of Susan, brings her to the store.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things is the Doris-Fred relationship evolves mm-hmm. totally off screen.
Yes.
We see it at different stages,
mm-hmm.
but we never see the middle parts. It's just, suddenly they're kind of making dinner together.
Well, this is what I mean. I mean, this movie, you could pick apart this movie to pieces and mm-hmm. about the character development, relationship development, whatever, what have you. But because it's a Christmas movie, you kind of give it the space to jump in time. You know, you don't necessarily have to do all the kind of things. That's why I think It's a Wonderful Life is such a incredible film, because it doesn't do that. It shows you. There are gaps in time, but it shows you what the progression of that relationship, good and bad, how it goes down, the roads it goes down.
This movie is light.
Yes.
You know, it's light and
for
it's
the
fun.
Most part. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it has some depth to it
does.
But it doesn't have heaviness put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And he's brought Susan to meet Santa.
Yes.
Well, young lady, what's your name?
Susan Walker. What's yours?
Mine? Kris Kringle. I'm Santa Claus. Oh, you don't believe that, do you?
Mm-mm. You see, my mother's Mrs. Walker, the lady who hired you.
Oh.
But I must say, you're the best-looking one I've ever seen.
Really?
Your beard doesn't have one of those things that goes over your ears.
Well, that's because it's real. Just like I'm really Santa Claus. Oh, go ahead. Pull it.
Oh, she's just so great at how questioning she is of everything.
And logical. And
logical,
just,
right.
And she's like, well, you look a lot better than the other Santas. And the other Santas have these bad beards.
And the glasses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, the, yeah, and then she, and he goes, oh, no, you could pull on it. And she pulls on it, and he has a reaction, which, by the way, he didn't do in rehearsal. He did it on the shoot, and she was surprised.
That's great.
And the other funny thing, this is according to several people interviewed about the movie.
Yeah.
What they said is Natalie Wood, the actress, really thought he was Santa.
Oh, wow.
And that is, in fact, a fake beard.
What?
Yeah, it's a fake beard.
How insane.
And when, at the end of the shoot, he took off his beard, and she saw him without the beard, she freaked out.
Well, we all get the lie shattered to us in different ways, man.
And while Susan is talking to Santa, Doris sees her.
Yes.
And she's not pleased.
Nope.
And I had to say something here.
Please. As a father.
As a father.
Yes, go ahead.
You can disagree with someone's parenting choices.
Sure.
You do not contradict their parenting choices without permission. Mm-hmm. If you don't like a parenting thing I'm doing, you come to me and have a conversation. Hey, why are you doing this thing?
Right.
You don't take my kid and do exactly the opposite of the thing that you know is what I want.
Right.
That if I'm saying my kid will never have fast food, you don't take my kid to McDonald's.
Right.
You
just because you think he should.
Just because you think he should.
Yeah.
That is exactly what Fred has done. And she is not pleased about it.
No, and she lets him know about it too.
Oh, yeah.
No uncertain terms.
Yeah. And she you know, doesn't want... She wants her to be sensible.
Yeah.
And she says, go away, Susan. Let me talk to Fred for a minute. And he says, oh, there's no harm in seeing Santa. And she goes, no, there is harm.
But I think there is harm. I tell her Santa Claus is a myth, and you bring her down here, and she sees hundreds of gullible children, meets a very convincing old man with real whiskers. This sets up a very harmful mental conflict within her. What is she going to think? Whom is she going to believe?
What do you, if you say believe in this thing and then that thing turns out to be a lie, what are you going to believe now?
Right.
What are you teaching your kid? That's what mom believes.
Mm-hmm.
And by filling them full of fairy tales, they grow up considering life a fantasy instead of a reality. They keep waiting for Prince Charming to come along. And when he does, he turns out to be a...
We were talking about Susie, not about you.
Which may have been the first recorded incident of, are we still talking about, or are we talking about you?
Yeah.
I love that. That may be the first recorded incident on a film.
Yeah. There's this Prince Charming thing that she starts to say.
Yeah.
And it hints that there was a dude in her life and something happened.
Right. And Susan says that, like, when she's talking to Gailey, like, I never know my father. Yeah. They divorced when I was a child. I was a baby.
Yeah. And by the way, the Catholic League gave this movie a B rating because it had a divorced mom in it. Because that was not cool.
Fuck them. Yeah. Anyway, sorry.
Weren't you raised Catholic?
I was. That's why I say that.
Now we're at one of my favorite scenes.
Mm.
We're back to Santa. Woman comes up with a daughter. Not a daughter. A little girl who's Dutch.
Yes.
Obviously had been trapped in an orphanage in World War II. Finally came over and really wanted to see Santa. And the mom is telling Santa, you know, explain to her that you wouldn't be able to speak her language.
Mm-hmm.
And she just insists that you're the real Santa.
Because she saw him in that parade.
She saw him in the parade.
There's something about him that she...
And she knows he'll be able to talk to her. And and the mom's going like, I don't know what to do. And what does Kris Kringle start doing?
Hello, ik ben blij dat je gekomen bent.
Oh, ben Sinterklaas.
Yes, zeker.
Ik wist het wel. Ik was zeker dat u het zou begrijpen.
Natuurlijk. Zeg maar wat je zou willen hebben, van Sinterklaas.
This scene, it made me cry.
Yeah, it's totally such a great got scene, me. Right? Because the little girl is so absolutely overwhelmed by his ability to do it.
Yeah. The joy in that moment is so big. And who is watching it from the shadows?
Yeah.
Susan.
Yep.
And again, this is where, as you say, Natalie's performance is great. Mm-hmm. Her taking in what she's seeing. You know, and of course, we know as filmmakers and actors, she probably was looking at nothing.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
you know what I mean? And yet her seeming to take in this really transformative moment of, and it's funny, it just occurred to me, for most kids, you believe in Santa, and then you have this horrible moment where you don't.
Right. Hers is the reverse.
Hers is the reverse.
This is great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It just occurred to me.
Yeah.
But now mom's going to give her a speech.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and mom is going to explain very logically and practically why this is just a very, very nice man, but he is not, in fact, Santa. And she's like, yeah, but the moment that he spoke Dutch, and Maureen O'Hara is like, look, I speak French, but that doesn't make me Joan of Arc. And in comes Kris Kringle. And what does she say? She says, please explain to my daughter that you are not Santa.
Well, I'm sorry to disagree with you, Mrs. Walker, but not only is there such a person, but here I am to prove it.
No, no, no. You misunderstand. I want you to tell her the truth. What's your name?
Kris Kringle. I'll bet you're in the first grade.
Second.
I mean your real name.
That is my real name. Second grade?
It's a progressive school.
Oh, it's a progressive school.
And she immediately is like, get me the employment records on our Santa. And this is where you could see she's starting to get worried.
Yeah.
And honestly, with good reason.
Of course.
This could be a crazy person.
Yeah, we're enjoying it because we're watching an audience, yeah. But in the reality of the film,
yeah.
It's unsettling.
And I love when they get the employment card and it says, the name is Kris Kringle. The address is this old folks home.
Yes.
In Brooklyn or something. But then... It also says, where is he from? North Pole. And it lists his next of kin as the reindeer. Now you can
in
see,
order.
In order.
That they appear. That they.
Oh, is that the correct
yes,
order?
Yes, it's the correct
oh,
order.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, on both sides.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, which is great. But Rudolph is missing. So it's interesting.
Well, Rudolph is a later invention. Yeah, Rudolph's right. Invented in the 50s.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's what.
I think. And you can see now Doris is getting to be seriously concerned.
Yeah.
Because you can't have a crazy person with kids on their laps all day, every day.
Right, and it says, what to say, old folks home or living retirement home, wherever there's an address there.
Yeah.
Long Neck, I remember that in the address. So he does have a base of operations. He doesn't right. have an address. He just has all this going on. And then he said old as teeth or something, as long as the tooth or something like that. I forget what it was.
Yeah.
Something about his age, yeah.
And now she realized she's going to have to fire this guy.
Yes.
And right as she's deciding that, Mr. Macy wants to see her. Mm-hmm. And we go up to see R.H. Macy, and he is now on board with this Macy's Cares idea. Right. He's like, this is the greatest thing ever. We'll recommend people to Gimbel's, and yeah, we'll lose a couple sales, but everyone will think of Macy's as the great store.
So there's no real noble instinct to it. It's about like, because he throws it away.
Oh, no.
Right at the end, he says the line, he says, and we'll make more money in that. He just throws it away at the end. And
no, well, that's going to come up several times yes. in several situations that yeah. there aren't actually noble instincts.
Right.
And no, you know what this reminded money. Me of, by the way, is the Heaven Can Wait, where it's like, why don't we be the tuna company that cares?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that's sort of this is one of those typical Hollywood wanting businesses to be nice things that's not really very realistic.
Right.
But he's really excited about this.
Yeah, because Julian's been called in there first.
Right.
And then Maureen O'Hara wants to chime in and correct him and
crazy.
See what happens. And he's like, no, don't say anything. And, yeah. and then he was like, we're going to get bonuses and we tricked him and blah, blah, blah. But yeah. then you're going to fire him. And she's like, what? You're going to fire him?
Because Julian's not really a good guy either.
No.
No, he's scared for his job
and he
cares about Macy's and he wants to sell more toys. And
right.
yeah, he's not doing this because he's a good guy.
Right.
I mean, we like him. He's
sure.
a likable person.
He's a decent fellow.
And we're in this sort of, do we fire him? Do we not fire him? Mm-hmm. And he's like, maybe he's a little crazy, you know, like painters.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Like yeah. painters are
cool. Oh, I think the whole line is like painters, composers, or some of those men in Washington.
That's brilliant.
It's a great line.
Yep.
And then they go, let's have Mr. Sawyer examine him,
mm-hmm.
who is doesn't seem to be a psychologist or a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. He's not really.
He ends up becoming the villain of the film.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. By far.
Yes.
And she tells Kris they're going to keep him on. And he kind of says, I'm worried about Christmas.
You see, Mrs. Walker, this is quite an opportunity for me. For the past 50 years or so, I've been getting more and more worried about Christmas. Seems we're all so busy trying to beat the other fellow in making things go faster and look shinier and cost less that Christmas and I are sort of getting lost in the shuffle.
Oh, I don't think so. Christmas is still Christmas.
Oh, Christmas isn't just a day. It's a frame of mind. And that's what's been changing. That's why I'm glad I'm here. Maybe I can do something about it.
This scene spoke to me of where I'm at right now in my life, because there's a lot of upheaval that is possibly going to happen over this Christmas time. Mm. And I have yet to be in the Christmas mood. Mm. And I don't even know if I'm going to be able to go home because of all this unsettling. And I'm so focused on trying to get that squared away that I have not had time to sit and feel Christmas and enjoy Christmas. And we're in the... almost the end of the first week of December. And
that's big for you.
Yeah, it is big for me. So yeah. I feel like I'm wading out of this all this unrest that's happening, this instability that's happening, to climb out of it so that I can enjoy Christmas this year. So I hope it does happen. I hope we get some answers soon, or I make some decisions soon so that I can just be relaxed, accept it, and go forward and enjoy Christmas. But we'll see what happens.
This idea of like, what is Christmas? Mm. And it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people.
Yeah.
And what is the holiday season and what it's about, you know? And, obviously, both in this movie and our world, the commercial aspects of it are huge.
Yeah.
You know?
But it's always about the belief of mankind, the better versions of ourselves that we can be, and also about being around friends and family, friends and family that care, and connect with them again, and just enjoy a communal experience of feeling connected to each other again.
Yeah. And that's what Chris wants to bring back. Mm-hmm. That's what he cares about.
Yep.
And he says this thing, which is, he says,
"And I'm glad I met you and your daughter. You two are a test case for me."
"We are?"
"Yes, you're sort of the whole thing in miniature. If I can win you over, there's still hope. If not, then I guess I'm through. But I'm warning you, I don't give up easily. Good night."
That's really setting up, this is what this movie's about. Mm-hmm. Can you win these two people over?
Right.
And she does tell him that he's going to have to take this mental exam. And he goes, "Oh, no problem. I've taken lots of those." And he recites the answers. You know, how many fingers you're holding up? Who's the first president of the United States?
Right.
Those aren't things that happen in a mental exam. I mean, exactly. There's some of them, but that's not really how psychiatry works, even in 1947.
Right.
And he says, "That's no problem." And she calls Brooks Memorial, which is the place that he's living, because she wants to talk to the doctor in charge to find out, you know, is this guy crazy?
In that moment, he's about to believe her, and then when she says you have to take these tests, he goes, all right, we're gonna have to go through this dance again,
because he's obviously been through this before.
Yes.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
You know, John, I don't have to tell you that I had a pretty rough month last month. I had family commitments, work stuff was a bit overwhelming, and frankly, my battery felt drained. And one of the ways that I looked to charge up that battery came through therapy.
Yeah, absolutely. Steve, you and I have both spoken about our therapy journeys here on the show. Certainly for me, one of the things that got me back in recharged, got me back connected to life, got me back ready to go and take control of my life was therapy. Once you go deep and find out what's going on, it's amazing how much more energetic, how much more you're willing to take part in your life. And therapy helps you do that for sure.
So if you're thinking of starting therapy, I'd give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/cinephiles today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/cinephiles.
So we're going to have a mental exam with Mr. Sawyer.
If you want to call it that.
Mr. Sawyer is just a horrible, horrible, awful person. And this does not go well. And as he's answering all the questions, and they seem to be many of the same questions that he anticipated, he's starting to go,
"You're rather nervous, aren't you, Mr. Sawyer? Do you get enough sleep?"
"My personal habits are of no concern to you."
"Oh, I'm sorry. It's just that I hate to see someone tied up in..."
"How many fingers do you see?"
"3. Oh, you bite your nails, too."
And Sawyer's like, "You're not examining me." And this is he is creating an enemy right here.
Right.
But Sawyer's not a nice guy.
Sometimes people don't want to hear the truth about themselves.
Yeah.
Because they want to be able to tell you the truth about yourself. And when you turn around them, they get real upset.
Yeah.
Do you recognize that actor, by the way?
No.
Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. He's one of the senators. Will you yield?
Will you yield? Right. Yeah, totally is. Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
In glasses.
Yeah. And he goes back to see Doris.
Yes.
And there's Dr. Brooks from the...
Oh, before you jump on, and we do realize Chris Kringle was right, because the psychiatrist, quote-unquote psychiatrist, wife calls, because he said, "Are you happy in your marriage?" And he goes, "Yes, I've been happy for 26 years." But then as soon as Chris Kringle leaves, the wife calls, and she's like, you make do with the money I gave you and an allowance of your idiot brother. So you know it's bullshit. And then he keeps picking at his eyebrow, and you can tell he's got the... And then the secretary is picking as well, because he's turned her into a basket case with his issues.
Yeah.
It's a terrible thing.
He's just a horrible person.
Yes.
Well, and you know what? Like, we trust certain experts.
Yeah.
And maybe some that we shouldn't. Yeah. People are just people.
Agreed.
So we meet with the doctor from the Brooks Institute, and also Mr. Sawyer.
Yep.
And Sawyer's like, he should be dismissed. He needs to be in a mental institution. He's got delusions. And Andy says this thing, that when a delusion is challenged, someone will become violent. And do you see the way he carries his cane?
Ooh.
And he's already setting up.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
These things that are going to happen. And the doctor from the institute where Chris lives, yeah, is like, he's a lovely person, yeah, and he will never become violent. That's not in his nature.
Right. But I think that's where we get that the psychiatrist is upset that he was able to analyze him so quickly, that he can see through his lie, that this is not a psychiatrist. The jig is up, right, for this guy, and he's very afraid he's going to get exposed by Kris Kringle.
And what they say about him is, you're really just hired to give intelligence exams.
Yeah.
He's not a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. He's got delusions himself. And in fact, when his delusions are challenged, he's the one who's going to be a,
right,
problem.
Right.
And then they come up with this idea that just doesn't make any sense at all, but you have to have advancing the movie, which is, well, the long train ride is the problem. Let's get him a place to live in town, and that will solve him being crazy. It doesn't make any sense, but they say, yes, that's a good plan.
He'll be less crazy if he's more rested.
Yeah, I guess that's the theory. And they go, okay, well, Julian, you have a spare room. And he goes, oh, okay, I'll make the martinis for my wife double strength tonight and get her essentially hammered.
Right.
And then she'll probably say yes to having Chris, yeah, come live with us. You're like, this is the plan here? And we go back home and Chris is with them. Oh, because we have to take Chris back to Susan's home,
yeah,
first.
Right.
Because we have to wait till Julian's wife gets hammered before we can ask her. So Chris is hanging out with Susan while Fred and Doris are now making dinner together. And this is where you see, like, oh, apparently the relationship is advancing on,
yeah,
some level.
All of a sudden. Yep.
And this is where Chris is saying, hey, basically, do you have an imagination?
Yeah.
And she really doesn't.
But what sort of games do you play with the other children in the apartment building here?
I don't play much with them. They play silly games.
They do?
Like today, they were in the basement playing zoo and all of them were animals. When I came down, Homer, he was supposed to be the zookeeper, he said, what kind of an animal are you? And I said, I'm not an animal, I'm a girl. And he said, only animals allowed here, goodbye. So we came upstairs.
Why would they pretend to be? She doesn't even get it. Mm-hmm. It's very strange. But pretty quickly, he gets her convinced. He does this great speech about imagination. What, yeah, if you can imagine that you could fly, that you could be a plane, that you could have gold and jewels, that you live in a castle, all these things. And you see Natalie Wood just moving forward,
mm-hmm,
and getting drawn into his spell.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I want to play games with,
sure,
Kris Kringle.
Especially that Kris Kringle.
And they start doing some monkey. It's really cute. And Doris and Fred are in the kitchen, and then he comes in to check on them and sees them playing monkeys, and, mm-hmm, he's just so happy.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, hey, you know what? Why don't you come live with me?
Yeah.
You know? Why? And it's so funny. He is such an open guy, his, mm-hmm, character, mm-hmm, Fred. He's just like wants to be friendly and wants to meet people. And he just accepts people really, really quickly.
Yeah.
He's a lovely, which is, I think, why he's in fact not creepy when he, right, did the creepy things, because he's just a lovely person.
Yep.
But we still got to get our phone call from Julian and his drunk wife, and it's a very funny little bit.
Yes.
It's a funny bit.
The phone yeah, thing, very funny.
Well, phone's upside down and, yeah, back and forth. And then it's really funny. Doris, who seems to be a very untrusting person and logical, not only is she kind of being instantly friendly with this guy across the hall who, mm-hmm, was hanging out with his daughter, but now the crazy Santa, she says, hey, crazy Santa, who I think is insane, put my daughter to bed.
Yeah.
Which she does. And it's a lovely, lovely scene. And he asks what she really wants for Christmas. And you can see that she has never told anyone this.
Right, yeah.
This is the first time she's bringing this up.
He says, take a chance on me or something like that, or trust, yeah, me. Yeah,
trust me.
Yeah, trust me.
I mean, well, and because this movie hinges on faith.
Yeah.
On the belief in things where you do not, which are beyond common sense. Mm-hmm. That's what this movie's about.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of levels to that. And this first one is, take a chance on me. Trust me.
Right.
And she reaches into a cabinet and she pulls out a picture of a house. She goes, this is what I want for Christmas. And he goes, oh, you want a doll's house? No, I want a real house. And she describes it, you know, with a fence and a swing in the back. And you could see Chris's face of kind of like, I don't know that I can deliver this.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
And she says, if you're really Santa, you can get it for me. And he tries to explain, just because every child doesn't get his wish doesn't mean there's no Santa.
Mm.
And you got a lovely apartment. And as he's saying this, you see her face kind of fall. And she, mm-hmm, just kind of goes, Oh, so I guess you can't do it, huh? And this is what her belief is hinging on right now, this moment.
Which is ironic, isn't it? Commercialism?
Yeah, gifts, I know, right.
Gifts equal Santa?
Well, and again,
it's a little bit...
I'm going to say something maybe a little controversial.
Sure.
But I had this epiphany about Santa a few years ago as I was thinking through it a lot. Is that in a weird way, Santa is kind of training wheels Jesus. Is that Santa... is you're going to believe in this thing.
Well, thanks for listening to Cinephiles.
Yeah.
As long as it lasted. They're going to burn us to the ground now. Yeah.
Well, it is believe in this thing that is going to check your sins. And
yeah, naughty and nice.
Naughty and nice.
Points.
And you believe in them despite evidence.
Yes.
And they have these magic powers to do things for you if you send them prayers, letters, you know.
Good point.
There's a lot of things where, like, there are parallels between religion and Santa.
Of course.
Yeah. And so that that's what this movie kind of gets into on some level is this idea of faith, of believing in things where we don't have evidence.
Right.
And what are the benefits of that? And how does that go against common sense? And how do we reckon with that in our world?
Well, if you do the history of religion and pagan rituals, like, there was always a winter pagan ritual, which eventually became Christmas. Jesus originally was not celebrated as being born on Christmas Day.
No,
like that was not. He was born in the middle of the year, like in June or something in the original calendars where it was made out. And then eventually it was moved to coincide with the pagan ritual. And so all of that, like, I'm not trying to I'm trying to discount religion at all because I'm a religious person. But I'm just saying, if you do the history and you read the history, it still doesn't take away the truth. But like, you can understand why. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
There's nothing wrong with celebrating it once a year, no matter when you celebrate it.
No.
Right.
Well, and you know, if you the argument between science and religion or facts and religion is as old as religion.
Exactly.
And
it's a tale as old as time. Right?
So he says he's going to try.
Yes.
He says he's going to try.
Mm-hmm.
And she blows a bubble and then goes to bed. And he goes to bed looking at the picture. And I love that they're in twin beds in Fred's apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And as they're talking, as Fred's getting ready for bed,
mm-hmm.
Chris is looking at that picture and he goes, you know what?
You know, I think you're right about Mrs. Walker. A little more effort on your part and she might crawl out of that shell. Take her out to dinner in the theater.
I've tried that. She's always too busy with her job.
Well, try a little harder. Those two are a couple of lost souls and it's up to us to help them. I'll take care of Susie if you'll take care of her mother.
It's a deal.
They're lost souls.
And by the way, that's okay to say.
Yeah.
I know with 2017 eyes, people might say, oh, that's paternalistic or patronizing or, you know, men thinking they need to save. But sometimes, regardless of gender, you need someone who recognizes that you're lost or broken or that you're caught in a shell and someone to step forward and take you out of that. And it's not from a place of wanting to own you or possess you or think you're lesser than. It's from a place of like, I care about you and I know you can be happier than you are right now. And there's nothing wrong with that.
I totally agree. I do think this movie came off watching it this time a little paternalistic, a little kind of male dominated. But again, this is a 70-year-old movie.
Sure, sure.
You know, I think, you know, but I totally agree with what you're saying. Everybody needs saving at some point. Yeah. You know, we all need to be saved.
Sure.
Now we're back at Macy's and there's this montage of all the people who work at Macy's looking at all the ads of all the other stores and they go, oh, go get that at Gimbel's. Go get that at Bloomingdale's. So obviously this is working in Gimbel. We go over to Gimbel's and Mr. Gimbel is pissed off. Oh, yeah. Why didn't we think of that? Why didn't we send our business to other places?
Right, right. And as true capitalism becomes a competition between two businesses.
Yeah, and Gimbel says, well, let's start doing it, and we'll do it at all our big stores.
We're doing it in Philadelphia. We'll do it in this or that.
Yeah. And Macy's go, well, we'll do it at all our stores in San Francisco and San Diego.
I love how quickly these board meetings work.
Yeah, apparently.
Which is not true at all in real life.
No.
Yeah.
And well, back then, maybe when R.H. Macy was around,
things I guess
went pretty
so.
Fast.
Make it happen.
Yeah, and now we have this big sort of photographic photo op with Mr. Macy and Mr. Gimbel and Santa. And I love that he gives Santa a bonus.
A check
right in front of Gimbel. And Gimbel's like, well, I'll give you some more. And Santa goes, well, I really want some money to get an x-ray machine. And there's this argument of like, well, I'll pay for the rest of the x-ray machine. I'll give it to you at cost.
I'll get it wholesale. Oh, yeah, okay. Cost.
Yeah. And they're both trying to outdo each other with their generosity.
Right.
If only things worked like that.
Which does not have any kind of nobility to it. It's a competition.
It's all a ploy. Yeah. It's still just as commercial. Well, I mean, and maybe this is in some ways this is our best bet is try to align self-interest with doing good.
Yeah.
If that's the way you could get the good stuff done.
Yeah.
You know, if like putting someone's name on Carnegie Hall or on a, you know, a library or something like that helps you to get the money for the library and it serves their ego.
Yeah.
Get the money for the library and serve their ego.
I guess you're
right. That's what you got to do. We're back to going to bedtime with Susan. Apparently this is becoming a regular thing. And he said, there's this moment he says,
"Now, like me to sing you a little goodnight song?"
"If you want to."
"Doesn't your mother ever sing to you at night?"
"Mm-mm. Why should she?"
And I'm like, what kind of mother has this been? Not that every parent has to sing a goodnight song.
No.
But like, she doesn't imagine with her. She doesn't read her. It's been like, this is the hard, cold, real world since you were a baby.
Right.
It's kind of rough. There
are no games here.
And then she blows a bubble. He wants some gum. He blows a bubble. We don't see it. We hear it and see her reaction.
Yeah.
Cut to Chris is picking gum out of his beard. Now we're back at Macy's in the commissary. I love these behind the scenes because that's really at Macy's.
Oh, wow.
So cool.
That's great.
Like the commissary for all the employees, which I'm sure is there. Yep. Have you been to the Macy's at Herald Square?
Yep.
It is big.
Yeah.
That is a big place.
Massive.
Yeah.
And Gimbel's. I've been to Gimbel's too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I have not. And we're sitting with Alfred, and Alfred is talking about, he learned some stuff about himself. Apparently he's got guilt and resentment. How did you hear this? Oh, Mr. Sawyer told me. I see him every day.
Yes. What else has he found wrong with you, Alfred?
Oh, just that I hate my father. I didn't know it, but he says I do.
And he sees you every day?
Yeah, I just sit in a chair and say anything that comes into my head.
Excuse me, Alfred. A few things have just come into my head, and I'm going to say them.
Well, I have some things have just popped into my head that I feel like you need to say, and then tears off there.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, this is awesome.
He goes and confronts Mr. Sawyer and just lays into him.
He really does. Calls him out, completely deconstructs his myth.
Are you a licensed psychiatrist?
What business is it of yours?
I have great respect for psychiatry and great contempt for meddling amateurs who go around practicing it. You have no more right to analyze Alfred than a dentist has to remove a gallbladder.
I beg your pardon.
Your job here, I understand, is to give intelligence tests. Passing yourself off as a psychologist. You ought to be horsewhipped. Taking a normal, impressionable boy like Alfred and filling him up with complexes and phobias?
I think I'm better equipped to judge that than you are.
Just because the boy wants to be good and kind to children, you tell him he has a guilt complex.
Having the same delusion you couldn't possibly understand. The boy is definitely maladjusted and I'm helping.
Maladjusted? You talk about maladjusted. Seems to me that the patient is running the clinic.
I won't step. Leave this office immediately.
Now, either you stop analyzing Alfred or I go straight to Mr. Macy and tell him what a malicious, contemptible fraud you are.
Get out before I have you thrown out.
And then he bonks him on the head with his cane. Which, by the way, is kind of what Sawyer said he would do.
It's an assault.
It is clearly, this is assault.
It's assault. Absolutely. You can argue that.
I mean, Sawyer's a horrible person.
Right.
But you shouldn't hit people in the head.
Well, also, what is interesting to pit these two people together, Sawyer is the lie, not Kris Kringle.
Right.
Sawyer is the lie because he's the one that's going to expose him for the lie that he is. Sawyer's not going to expose Kris Kringle. Kris Kringle's going to expose Sawyer, which I love.
Yeah. Well, except that's not really what happens.
Well, but that's what they had the back and forth about.
Yeah. And of course, Sawyer, as you say, he's the lie because Doris comes and looks for him, he fakes being unconscious.
Right. That look up and then... Yeah, they look up and look down. Yeah.
Because now he is scheming to get rid of Kris.
Yeah.
And
again, because Kris sees through his lies.
So, and now we with Julian, we've got this plan. We're going to get him out of the store on a pretext.
Yeah.
And they come to him and say, "Hey, we want you to take some pictures with the mayor."
Yeah.
And he says he was supposed to meet Mr. Macy because he was going to tell him about Sawyer.
Mm-hmm.
But no, they get him outside. They get him to the car. He gets in the car. Sawyer gets in the car.
Right.
Where to? Bellevue,
man.
And the look on Edmund Gwen's face,
his
face just falls.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so, the question he asks is, does she know about this? Meaning Maureen O'Hara. Yeah. And yes, we all discussed it.
Which is a lot.
Yeah.
Because she didn't want to have part of it.
No. I mean, she knew that stuff had happened. She didn't know about Bellevue.
But she didn't want him to be,
Fred at his lawyer's office gets a call.
Yes.
To go to Bellevue. He goes to Bellevue and there's Kris in a robe.
Yes.
With the crazy people.
And he looks kind of crazy.
Yeah.
He's got his arms folded.
Yeah.
He's not happy with it. Yeah.
And he asks, why'd you do it? Because he deliberately failed the exam because we knew that he could pass it. And it's because she had doubts. She didn't really believe in anything.
But why didn't she come to me and explain the whole thing?
She didn't want to hurt you.
But only because I was a nice, kind old man and she was sorry for me.
That's not true.
Yes, it is. She had doubts. That's why she was just sorry. If you'd been dragged off here instead of me, she wouldn't have been sorry. She'd have been furious.
All right, she had doubts. Why not? She hasn't really believed in anything for years. You can't expect her to suddenly...
Oh, it's not just Doris. There's Mr. Sawyer. He's contemptible, dishonest, selfish, deceitful, vicious. And yet he's out there and I'm in here. He's called normal and I'm not.
And Fred is like, well, you're important to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Like Susie, who are just starting to believe. And he goes, you can't quit. You can't let them down. And he kind of stands up and he goes, you're right. Let's get out of here.
Yeah.
You can't get out of here. Because now the doctors have decided you're crazy and right. need to be committed.
Because you lied yeah. or you failed
test.
The test, yeah.
Now, even in 1947, this is not how involuntary commitment worked. It was not like you just don't remember the name of the president of the United States and now you're for committed. Life stuck in Bellevue.
Right, right.
It's not actually how it works. But that's how it works in this movie.
Sure.
Macy, Mr. Macy, is not pleased. He yells at Sawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, you got to go fix this. And we
or
go,
you're going to get another bonk on the head.
Or you're going to get another bonk on the head. And we go to the judge and the prosecutor guy comes in and says, oh, we got some routine commitment papers for you to sign. He's about to sign them. In comes in Fred representing Chris Kringle, comes in right at the last minute. Again, yeah. This doesn't seem like how a legal system would probably work. And he requests a formal hearing. And Sawyer, this is the last thing he wants. And he tries to convince Fred, like, no, let's just keep this whole thing quiet. And
we'll
pay you off. Yeah. And the last thing Macy's want is publicity. And Fred's last moment is publicity. What an interesting idea. So it's in the newspapers. Doctors doubt sanity of Goodwill Santa.
Right.
And we get those classic 40s sort of newspaper montages.
Yeah, spinnings, yeah.
Yeah, it's all great old stuff. And I love the judges at home, and he's talking to William Frawley.
Yes.
Fred Mertz.
Right.
Who plays a great cigar-chewing political operative tough guy.
Yeah.
You know, seems like an old-school union guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying, you cannot commit Santa Claus. It will ruin your career.
And I'm telling you, get off this case.
But why?
Because you're a regular Pontius Pilate the minute you start, that's why.
Oh, I don't believe it. I'm an honest man. And nobody's going to hold it against me for doing my duty as I see it.
And in come the grandkids.
Yeah.
Grandma! Grandma! Grandma!
And they walk right by him. They don't give him a hug.
They give him the, I love that. And I love Frawley's line where he's like, I don't know a habeas from a corpus, but I know politics, and that's my bag, and I'm telling you.
Yeah. Frawley's great.
Mm-hmm.
He's really, really good. And again, we get to this thing. This is the same thing you said about Macy's.
Yeah.
The reason that the judge doesn't want to commit Santa has nothing to do with... him being compassionate,
right?
It's all political.
Well, this is what to me rings hollow about the last part of the movie, the third act of the movie. There's no real, in essence, victory at the end because this is all done for political expediency. It's not done from authenticity, and that kind of bothers me a little bit.
Well, it's funny because watching it this time, that hits so strongly.
Yeah,
you know, because I'd watched it when I was a kid.
Sure.
Because when I was a kid, it's funny. As a kid, I was like Kris Kringle's Santa in the movie, you know, and watching it now, I was kind of like, oh, all these political and business reasons are allowing him to, why people are, they're not believing, nobody's believing he's Santa.
Right.
They're saying it's expedient or profitable or politically advantageous to say he's Santa.
Right.
That is kind of, that's where we were talking, like, there's some deepness in here.
Yeah.
And again, the thing I was thinking about, because there's this parallel with religion, is how many politicians have to prove their religious bona fides to get elected?
Right.
Like, people don't get elected president unless they claim to be religious, even though we can be pretty sure that many of them probably weren't that religious.
Right.
You know, but that is a requirement in American politics. And that's sort of what's happening with, you can't say Santa doesn't exist and get elected again.
Right.
That's what seems to be happening.
No one takes a principal stand here. I mean, other than obviously Gailey does, but like.
Does he?
To me, he does because I think.
Well, we'll get to that.
Yeah, okay.
So we're at trial. And again, Chris Kringle is lovely and yes. smiles at everyone. He takes the sand. He swears, tells the truth. And the judge, you can see him trying to be super nice.
Yeah, he's trying to lead him into another area, right?
Because he keeps making eye contact with William Frawley. How am I doing? How am I doing? Because you can't be mean to Santa. And he says, name's Chris Kringle. And he says where he lives. Or he asks, where do you live? And Chris Kringle's response is great.
That's what this hearing will decide.
And everyone gets a big laugh. And do you believe you're Santa Claus? Of course. And the prosecution rests.
Right.
They say, that's it. He's crazy. And the judge is like, well, maybe you didn't understand the question correctly. And he's like, no, I understand it.
Like you're playing Santa Claus. He's yeah. like, no, you got maybe you got confused. He's like, I'm not confused about anything.
Yeah. Yep. And the defense comes up and says, so the issue is that he's crazy because he believes he's Santa Claus. Yes, that's the issue.
Anyone who thinks he's Santa Claus is not sane.
Not necessarily. You believe yourself to be Judge Harper, yet no one questions your sanity because you are Judge Harper.
I know all about myself, young man. Mr. Kringle is the subject of this hearing.
Yes, Your Honor. And if he is the person he believes himself to be, just as you are, then he's just as sane.
Granted, but he isn't.
Oh, but he is, Your Honor.
Is what?
I intend to prove that Mr. Kringle is Santa Claus.
So here's you said before that he is acting honorably.
Yeah.
And I think he is. He's a good guy. Totally a yes, good yes, guy. Yes. Does he believe that Chris Kringle is Santa Claus?
I think he believes that Chris Kringle believes he's Santa Claus. And what he argues is logical. That, and this is what I mean. The film is a little subversive in its way. That every man has a right to decide and every woman has a right to decide who they are in their lives. And he says to him, the judge, he says to the judge, why are you the judge? Because you say you're the judge and because you've done these things and then you're and we.
But, wait, but who he are is really? The judge.
Yeah, well, yes.
I mean, he has the job.
Yeah.
Presides over courts.
Right. But he told himself at some point, I'm going to be this and I'm going to do this. And I am this now. And that's what he's saying. Chris Kringle may have just told himself he's this or maybe that, but he's allowed to designate who he is. He's allowed to do this.
I don't think that's what he's saying. What do you think he's saying? He's saying that he is, in fact, he is going to prove that.
No, you're asking me what Gailey believes.
Oh.
Now yes. I'm telling you what I believe that Gailey believes, not what he's defending in
right.
court.
Well, this is the thing, is that right. I don't think that he thinks that Chris Kringle is the real Santa Claus.
Okay.
Because at the end of the movie,
yeah,
he just thinks he did a great job trying right. the case. He has a discovery at the end.
Which the reaction from Kane, yeah.
Yeah, was because he goes, oh, wow, wait, yeah. maybe I'm not as good a lawyer as I thought I was, mm-hmm. which is essentially saying, oh, shit, maybe he's really Santa Claus.
Right.
So I think he's come up with a... Because what Gailey's interested in is the imagination and belief.
Right.
Not necessarily... I don't think he's a guy... Is he a guy that believes that there's a guy in the North Pole
right.
who flies around with all the houses on a sled and goes down chimneys? I don't know that he believes that.
Right.
But that is what he's now said he's going to prove. And the room goes nuts.
Right.
William Frawley's not pleased.
Mm-hmm.
And we cut away. And we're back with Doris. She's read, it's in all the papers.
Yeah.
Fred's really excited that it's yes. in all the papers. Again, we get the sense that their relationship has kind of evolved
mm-hmm.
to a new level of intimacy.
Calling her honey and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. They're clearly a couple now.
Yeah.
And she doesn't like this idea. She's like, you're not serious about this. You can't possibly prove this.
Mm-hmm.
And they have an argument. And I think this scene is great.
Yes. Agreed.
I think this scene is really at the heart of the movie
mm-hmm.
because, you know, he's jeopardized his position at the law firm. He's like, oh, I quit the law firm.
Oof.
She says he's a nice old man, but you have to be realistic and face facts. And he goes, no, I'll just open my own office. She goes, well, what kind of cases you'll get? Well, probably cases like him.
Mm-hmm.
And I promise you, if you believe in me and have faith in me, everything will...
And she walks away from him.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have any faith in me, do you?
Which is huge.
This is big stuff.
Right.
And this idea of faith, and what does it mean? And we have faith on a lot of levels
sure,
here.
Sure, sure, sure.
Because we have sort of this idea of like imagination. We have that.
Right.
And we have faith in Santa Claus. Is there really this mystical being that does all this stuff?
Yeah.
But then we have faith in people. And the movie kind of relates them all.
Yep.
In ways, I don't know if that they're all exact. They're all very, to me, they're all very different things.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this moment of... She's like, this is what's practical and reasonable, and this is what we have to do. And he's saying, believe in me.
Right.
It's not a question of faith. It's just common sense.
Faith is believing in things when common sense tells you not to. Oh.
Don't you see? It's not just Chris that's on trial. It's everything he stands for. It's kindness, Fred, and joy and love and all the other intangibles.
Oh, Fred, you're talking like a child. You're living in a realistic world, and those lovely intangibles of yours are attractive but not worth very much. You don't get ahead that way.
That all depends on what you call getting ahead.
But once again, it's that what we saw from the beginning with her issues of not wanting to believe in Prince Charming. Now, and he calls her out. He says to her, you know, because she's basically saying, this is not how the real world works.
Right.
You can't throw your career away on a fancy, on a flight, or a frivolous cause or whatever. And he says, but I'm doing it for the grander, like there's a greater purpose here of what I'm doing. There's a greater good. And she says, that greater good isn't how the real world works. And he says, you know what? And she goes, and she says, that's not how you get ahead.
Right.
And then he says to her,
look, Doris, someday you're going to find out that your way of facing this realistic world just doesn't work. And when you do, don't overlook those lovely intangibles. You'll discover they're the only things that are worthwhile.
And he walks out.
Yeah.
And damn if that isn't a fucking great, that's just a great scene.
It's great.
And it's a stance because he's not berating her or insulting her. He's saying, these are my beliefs. I see your beliefs. I'm going to tell you in the future, you're going to realize those beliefs, those things that keep you warm, they're not the right things to be believing in, because at the end of the day, that is all fleeting. But believing in people is where the real currency is.
Well, and in kindness and love and all those things he talks about, that's what he thinks he's fighting for. And there's a really key line, I think, because you said, she says, that won't help you get ahead.
Right.
And he says, it depends on what you mean by getting ahead.
Yes.
That to me,
yes.
What do you mean by getting ahead is like one, maybe the most important line in the movie for me.
Yep.
Because particularly today, far more so than 1947.
So true.
We have framed the world as basically everyone's goal is about getting more money
and becoming famous or whatever.
Yeah. And in my experience with people in the world, and I've known people that were quite wealthy and I've known some people that were famous, those things do not bring happiness or contentment or joy or fulfillment. They people need money, and the lack of money, there are all these studies about happiness. And what most of them say is like the lack of money, if you're kind of below the poverty line and always struggling, it's very hard to be happy.
Yes.
But once you get a sufficient amount, more money does not bring more happiness.
Right.
And that there are all these things that give us joy, connection and family and community and you know, the pride in your own work, and, you know, and maybe it's going dancing, and maybe it's, you know, climbing, rock climbing, and maybe it's playing chess or whatever it is. Those things bring joy. And that's why, like, it depends on what you mean by getting ahead.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, if you could figure out what you mean by getting ahead, and what really gives you fulfillment and joy and contentment and a sense of who you are as a person, and follow that, that's great.
Yeah.
But if you're just going, I got to get some money, it's not going to work out well.
Right, right.
And that's what Fred's saying in this scene. It's a really, really good scene.
I agree.
Yeah. And then we go to the prosecutor, and he's kind of, and everyone's attacking him, and his wife is apparently agreeing with the reporters that are attacking him.
Yeah.
And he says, I have a duty. And his son's not very happy with him. And really, the truth is, he likes Kris Kringle.
Yeah.
I think everyone does. Nobody wants to be doing this. And there's so we're back heading into the trial. Kris runs into Alfred. They have a nice little moment.
Oh,
so it's sweet. Just very sweet. And then R.H. Macy testifies. And basically, it comes down to this question of, do you believe he's Santa Claus?
Mm-hmm.
And you see in his head,
PR.
And he sees what would happen if he didn't say that.
Yeah, exactly.
And he says, yes, I believe he's Santa Claus.
Right.
He perjures himself.
In essence.
Because it seems very clear he doesn't believe he's Santa Claus.
Right.
But he wants the world to think he believes that.
Mm-hmm.
And the prosecutor says, look, this doesn't matter. There is no, you have to prove that Santa Claus exists. There's no such person. He doesn't exist.
Right.
And again, you know, the connections to religion of, you can't disprove the existence of God, you know, that sort of idea, that's kind of related to what's happening.
Yeah.
And of course, everyone looks to the judge and say, we need a ruling on whether or not there's Santa Claus.
Mm-hmm.
And Frawley gives the judge a very serious, don't do this wrong look. And he goes, well, I'll have to retire to my quarters, to my chambers, to contemplate this and do some research.
Right.
And Frawley comes in and says, you can't say there's no Santa Claus.
I don't care what you do with old Whiskerpuss, but if you go back in there and rule that there's no Santa Claus, you better start looking for that chicken farm right now. Why, we won't even be able to put you in the primaries.
The whole economy depends upon Santa Claus.
You get two votes.
Yeah.
You'll get yourself, or your wife, rather, and the district attorney or
yeah.
whatever.
And that's it. And that's because all the people that make toys and work mm-hmm. in stores and all the mothers of kids and the grandparents of kids and all the people that deliver the toys, all those people are going to hate you.
Right.
Again, it's just political.
It's a hollow victory.
Well, I don't know if it's a... Certainly the reasons that we have a victory are hollow.
I don't want to hurt people's feelings who love this movie so much.
Yeah.
But damn it, it's a hollow victory because there's not really two sides entrenched fighting this out for a judge that's impartial and willing to hear it. It's all slanted so that he can get certified as Kris Kringle. It's slanted.
Well, except what is that is not the victory. The trial is not what the movie is about. The movie is about getting Susan and Doris to believe in him.
Sure.
That's what we set up. They say they're the test case. You work on the mom.
Right. Susan had already crossed that line.
She was close, I guess. Right, yeah. She's pretty darn close.
And Doris was needed a little more time. Yeah.
It's not, you know, no one expects the government to actually say they're Santa Claus.
Right.
But so the judge comes back out.
Yeah.
And he says he consulted the highest authority, whatever that means.
Whatever that means.
And he says the court will have an open mind and puts it on Fred. Can you put any evidence to support this? And Fred goes, yes, I can. And in calls the prosecutor's son.
Yeah.
Hello, Daddy.
This is so great. And he brings him up. And you see the prosecutor just like, oh, what's going to happen?
Yeah.
Do you believe in Santa Claus, Tommy?
Sure I do.
What does he look like?
There he is, sitting there.
Your Honor, I protest.
Overruled.
Tell me, Tommy, why are you so sure there's a Santa Claus?
Because my daddy told me so. Didn't you, Daddy?
The prosecutor's like going, yes. And apparently, according to the guy who played that kid,
yeah,
he made up that line that daddy told me.
Wow.
It seems weird that was a line figured out by a little kid on the set, but that's mm-hmm. what he says. And he wouldn't tell me anything that wasn't so. Mm. And the prosecutor goes, no, I wouldn't. And then, bye, Daddy. And the prosecutor concedes the existence of Santa Claus.
Yes.
It's really fun. And Frawley likes this. William Frawley, it's funny how big a character he becomes with his presence.
In the third part of the movie, yeah.
Yeah. And now we have the scene with Susan and Doris. Again, it's kind of happened off camera.
Yeah.
But suddenly, Susan starts to say she believes he's Santa, and Doris thinks, perhaps you're right.
Mm-hmm.
I think he is, too. And we don't know why she's now made this transition. Do you think she's made the transition, Doris?
Yes.
Because she really has come to believe this, or because she's come to believe that it's important for Susan to believe?
No, I think she made because of what Fred says to her. I think she's had time to think about...
To think about it.
Yeah, about what he said. And so it ends up opening her up again because she's been afraid to believe. Because obviously this guy who left, or the divorce... Yeah. Really hurt her, really destroyed her dreams of a Prince Charming, sort of dreams of a life that she was a very happy life she was going to have. And so she needed to believe again, not just in Santa, but in love, in happiness, in joy, and that it wasn't going to be taken away. And so Gailey has done his due diligence through the whole movie to try to get her to believe, open up and believe in her, right? And so I think that's what happens.
And she convinces Susan to write a letter.
Mm-hmm.
She writes a letter saying, I believe in you.
Yeah.
And then Doris at the very bottom writes, I believe in you too.
Right. Really great.
It's really great. And we go to the post office where there are all these letters coming in for Santa. And they start talking about, God, what are we going to do with all these letters? And they find the one that's directed to the courthouse. Hey, that's weird.
Right.
Why is this letter directed to the courthouse? And then they go, oh, because of the trial that's going on. Mm-hmm. And then this great postman says, guy working in the post office says,
Hey, Lou, how many Santa Claus letters we got down at the dead letter office?
I don't know. There must be about 50,000 of them. Bags and bags all over the joint, and there's more coming in every day.
Yeah. Hey, Lou.
Yeah.
Kind of nice to get rid of them, wouldn't it, huh?
Yeah, but...
Do you know who that actor is? Because I didn't. I only saw...
Jack Albertson.
It is Jack Albertson.
Yes.
I had no idea until I just was scrolling through IMDb and saw his name.
Yeah.
Yeah, from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory and Chico and
Fuck
the Man.
Grandpa Joe.
Exactly. we go back to the courthouse. Kris is reading the letter, and he's kind of like, I've won.
Yeah.
But Fred thinks he's failed.
Right.
You know, like I can't figure out how to prove you're Santa.
Right.
And a guy comes in and kind of makes some gestures to some big things. And Fred goes out. And then the trial has continued. Apparently, they started without the defense attorney, and the prosecutor is saying, hey, he's given us no evidence that this is the that this is Santa. And then in walks Fred.
Yeah.
And he says, here, or first he says, let me tell you some facts about the post office. And he starts rambling off about Ben Franklin and how many letters they carry. And the court concedes that, yes, the post office is a really great part of the federal government.
Right.
And that it's run very efficiently. And he says, here are three letters. And there are three letters addressed to Santa that have been delivered here to Kris Kringle. And he goes, well, three letters aren't proof. And Fred goes, well, I do have some more proof. And the judge says, yes, bring it all here. Put it on my desk. Are you sure you want it on the desk? Yes, yes, yes. Put it on the desk. And in comes the parade of mail sacks.
Right.
It's almost like the opposite moment from Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Yeah.
That Mr. Smith is here. I'm going to crush you with these letters. It's and it's fake horrible. Letters.
Yeah.
No, those are real letters in Mr. Smith.
Yeah, but they've made people write them.
Yes, yes.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, I'm not sure which letters are faker.
Fake news.
Faker, the letters to Santa or the letters...
Well, the letters to Santa are written from a pure place.
Absolutely. Which absolutely. Yeah. Yes, I totally agree. I shouldn't have even said that.
So how dare you?
I know, I'm sorry.
Fake letters. Hashtag fake letter.
And they dump all these letters on top of the judge's desk.
Yeah.
And I love there's a great rack focus to his face, and the judge says...
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it. Case dismissed.
Wow.
And we win.
That's right. What an incredible cop-out. What an incredible cop-out. It seems a bit... That's the thing about this movie, is it's really enjoyable. And then that ending, there's no morality to it. Like, the judge isn't, like, taken over by some sense of nobility or morality or sense of doing the right thing. It's pressure from his family. It's political pressure. It's the desire to retain his job. And then he finds his cop out with those letters and with that.
Well, what is the right thing?
The right thing would have been if his heart was legitimately moved in a certain way to believe this man is Santa Claus, or to believe that he has a right to exist and call himself Kris Kringle because it's his own personal belief and not pressure from William Frawley, from Fred sitting in the gallery.
So you think the only way out of this is if people... If this judge in the Supreme Court of New York actually believes that there is a real Santa Claus who lives at the North Pole, who flies around on Christmas Eve and delivers presents.
No. That's too outlandish. What I think is he has the right to say this man has a right to call himself what he would like to call himself. He has a right to self-determination. And I think that is what Fred is saying. Fred is saying the man has a right to self-determination in essence, and the judge is taking away his right to self, or the judge has to decide his right to self-determination. Because he can say, I'm from the North Pole, and this is my address, and I'm Kris Kringle, blah, blah, blah. And if the judge says, that's right, you have a right to call yourself that, which is what Fred's argument was. How do we know you're the judge because you went to call, you say
you're Fred's argument, but he is the judge. I mean, like, the argument is based on, I mean, this man has a degree, he does this job, he goes to this, you know, like, he is who he says he is.
Right.
And Fred's argument is that Kris Kringle is, in fact, the one and only Santa Claus. And so...
Well, I think Fred's argument is that he can say he's the one and only Santa
Claus. No, that is not the argument.
No, that's your interpretation of the argument.
He literally says, I'm now going to bring back the quote where he says, I will prove that this man is the one and only Santa Claus.
Okay.
And if he is the person he believes himself to be, just as you are, then he's just as sane.
Granted, but he isn't.
Oh, but he is, Your Honor.
Is what?
I intend to prove that Mr. Kringle is Santa Claus.
Because, and here's the thing, is that the judge and everybody else in this situation is in a trap. And the trap is that, and now this is a sort of a silly trap because I don't believe this is realistic. Mm-hmm. If he continues to say he's Santa Claus, he must go to Bellevue and be committed for the rest of his life. And nobody wants that to happen. Everybody thinks that is wrong. Mm-hmm. And now they're trying to find a legal way to get out of the trap.
A loophole.
A loophole.
Yes.
And so to me, it is the moral choice to say, okay, you're Santa Claus, even though nobody in this movie believes that.
Wait, but he didn't do it from a moral place. He does it from a place of afraid to lose his job and the election and blah, blah, blah.
Absolutely.
So there's
true.
No morality here at all. At all. It's all the fix is in. The fix is in.
For a good cause.
Well, sure, but it's still a fix. Where's the morality in that?
Everything you say is true. That is all true.
I'm saying.
Yeah.
Look, if I know a team cheats and they cheat to win, and then I cheat to beat that team that cheats, who is better here?
I don't think that's a good analogy.
I think it's a perfect analogy.
I think we're talking about a nice old man who's going to get put away for the rest of his life.
Sure, that's when you break it down. But Fred does not believe he's that. You asked me this earlier, didn't you?
Like, yeah.
Do you think Fred thinks he's Santa Claus? And I said, I don't think Fred thinks he's Santa Claus. I think Fred thinks he has the right to say he's Santa Claus.
I think Fred thinks he's a nice old man that we're better off having him around,
right?
Thinking he's Santa Claus. He's not hurting anybody. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so, and I guess, yeah, I agree. He has the right to say that he's Santa
Claus. That's all. And Fred is not, and because Fred doesn't even believe he's Santa Claus.
Yeah.
So yeah. Either way, the fix is in my opinion. And I don't mean to ruin this movie for anybody else. And of course, Steve, more than welcome to your opinion of it, but I just think the fix is in, and it takes away from me a little bit of the magic of the movie that
I think you're right. I actually agree. They're doing everybody, R.H. Macy, the judge, district attorney, William Frawley, all these people are doing what they're doing for cynical reasons.
Right.
But I also go like, well, what else are we going to do? Because we don't want to put this guy away in Bellevue. So what's our solution? You know?
Yeah.
But you're right.
I just think the movie could have written a better solution where the judge, even with the pressure, actually has a crisis of conscience and says, irrelevant of what, like, puts his family in their place and says, you don't get to tell me how I judge or blah, blah, blah. I have to make the decision. Maybe he has a speech with his daughter or his kids and says, listen, I understand why you're upset, but this is why daddy does what he does because of this, this, and this. And then he has it. Then his family understands his decision. And then also with Fred, maybe he pushes back Fred Mertz, whatever his name is. Is it William Frawley?
William Frawley.
Frawley's political intimidation about the unions and all this stuff.
Right.
And says to him, I don't care about the unions. My job is to serve the state of New York and to serve the people of this country and of this state. And this is what, and I have to live and die by my decisions from my own belief. That's why I was elected to this position, to give my opinion on this. So there was another way out of this that I think would have been morally more correct for a Christmas movie for this particular character.
You know what's occurred to me, because I think everything you're saying is accurate, is that, you know, we talked about a comparison with It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
You know, because they're both sort of the classic black and white Christmas films. Mm. And now I'm actually thinking, you know what's almost a better comparison in some ways is Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
It absolutely is.
And part of it is that the character of Mr. Smith is a completely idealistic, doesn't really understand how the world works, believes in all these things that people give lip service to, but don't really believe is reality, placed in a very, very dark and cynical world.
Yeah.
And in some ways, that's what's happening here. And it's funny that we even have all the letters coming in, which happens at the end of Mr. Smith, is that the world, all the businesses and everyone, including Doris, are cynical people.
Right.
And here we put this completely uncynical, naive person into that world and see what happens.
But I also think the difference is that Jefferson Smith fights to the end, sees the corruption, and still fights to the end, changes Gene Arthur's opinion of the whole situation. Claude Rains tries to commit suicide because of the crisis, his own crisis of conscience, and things have changed. Things are changed from this stand he makes.
Yeah. So, yeah. All right, but we find that he is in fact Santa Claus, and there's a kind of a lovely moment where Chris has this moment with Doris where he thanks her for the letter, because in a lot of ways, him getting the letter saying, I believe in you too, that she and Susan both believe, that's the real triumph for Chris. It's not the court case. The court case isn't the thing. And he says, why don't you come tomorrow, Christmas Day, to the Bricks home where he lives? Mm-hmm. We're having a party. And she goes, why don't you come tonight for Christmas Eve? And he's like, I can't tonight. Which sort of makes me wonder, where does Chris go?
Chris goes to deliver the presents.
Apparently.
Clearly.
We're at the Brooks home, and Alfred and Chris, both dressed as Santa Claus, are giving out the presents. Susan runs in, goes straight for the tree. What's she looking for? Her house.
Right.
It's been proven that this guy's Santa Claus, therefore she has to get what she asked for. And there's a great shot where the doctor who runs the Brooks home walks up and sees that x-ray machine. And his face is just perfect.
Yeah, man.
And he says, you know what?
Chris, all I can say is the state Supreme Court declared you to be Santa Claus, and personally and professionally, I agree with them.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
It's a great, great moment.
That's the moment.
Oh, it's great. It's beautiful. And unfortunately, Susan doesn't find that present.
No.
And she's disappointed and upset. And Chris says, you know, apologizes, I'm really sorry. And Susan says,
you couldn't get it because you're not Santa Claus, that's why. You're just a nice old man with whiskers, like my mother said. And I shouldn't have believed you.
That's rough.
It's tough.
Yeah. And her mom says,
I was wrong when I told you that, Susie. You must believe in Mr. Kringle and keep right on doing it. You must have faith in him.
And then Mom says to her daughter what Fred said to her. Faith is believing in things when common sense tells you not to. Mm-hmm. And Susan is, she's on the fence. And then this really strange moment where Chris says to Fred, hey, here's some directions on how to drive home. And he gives them a little note. They'll miss some traffic. And we cut to the car and they're driving, trying to follow Chris's directions. And Susan is saying, I believe, I believe, I believe. And then suddenly she yells,
stop, Uncle Fred, stop!
They stop the car and she runs out of the car up to a house with a for sale sign is in front of it, which is the exact house that was the picture that she had given to Chris earlier.
Incredible.
And she runs into the house and Doris and Fred are going, what the heck is going on? Right. And they go into the house and she yells, this is it. This is the house I wanted. She's the one she asked Mr. Kringle for. And she's walking around and she runs upstairs and finds her room and she finds the swing in the back and everything is perfect. And then she just says that she says what Doris just said to her.
Oh, you were right, Mommy. Mommy told me if things don't turn out just the way you want them to the first time, you still got to believe. And I kept believing and you were right, Mommy. Mr. Kringle is Santa Claus.
And Fred looks at Doris. And this moment, it just makes me cry.
Yeah.
Can't help it. Because he goes, wait, you told her what? Because then there's something about hearing that... This is just good screenwriting, too.
Yeah.
Is that if she had told him, I now agree with you, that would not have been as dramatic as him hearing it from Susan.
Right.
Yeah, that's what really, really gets you.
Especially because Susan is the one who he, in essence, used at the beginning of the movie to get a dinner date with.
That's a great point.
Yeah, it just is a full circle.
It brings it around full circle.
Yeah.
And then there's a great, and then they just kiss.
Right.
And there's the first kiss I think we see between the two of them.
Yes.
Yeah. And he says, you know, we've made all these plans. The house is for sale. We wouldn't want to disappoint him. And they're all really happy. And then there is this moment where Fred looks in the corner, and there is the cane.
There's the cane. And he is like, you don't think like that. Yeah.
Well, and here's a question for you.
Yeah.
Is the movie telling us that Kris Kringle is, in fact, Santa Claus?
I think the better thing to think about this movie is to not have an answer for me.
Right.
It is more about what the theme of this whole what she says, of what Fred says to Doris first, and then what Doris says is this idea of having faith.
Right.
What is it? Having faith when others don't believe. Or what is it?
When common sense tells you not.
Common sense tells you not to. Yeah. And that's what it was. That's what this movie is really all about, is having faith when common sense tells you. So common sense, you look at that cane, common sense tells, there's no way. How could it be? But it doesn't matter, because what matters is the house. What matters is that they're going to be together. What matters is the room is set up the way Susan wanted. What matters is that there's hope and possibility for the three of them as a new family.
Right.
And that's what's really important. Who cares if he's Santa Claus or not?
It's funny. When I was a kid, because I watched this movie a bunch as a kid, there was no question that he was Santa Claus. Of course he was Santa Claus. Right. The cane proved he was Santa Claus. Right. And now watching as an adult, I'm like, well, there's no question that he found the house and he gave them the directions specially to go there. So he'd been to the house, so he could have left his cane. And now watching, I go, no, everything in this movie says that he's not Santa Claus, that he is. But I kind of like your answer better, which is that we get to just live in this mystery, you know, and get to play with this idea of faith. So a couple of things about finishing this movie. I know I said when we started that the two people that had the right to end this film are Mr. Macy and Mr. Gimble, or really the company's Macy's and Gimbles. Fortunately, they love the film. So it did get to go on. But then Daryl Zanuck liked the movie so much that he said, we need to release it in the summer because that's when movies make more money.
What?
Yes. So they decide to release it in the middle of summer.
Oh.
And then they say, well, it's going to sound weird releasing a Christmas movie in the summer. So they took all Christmas out of the marketing.
What?
So if you look at the original poster, there's like a picture of Fred and Doris and Susan. And in the background is this old man with whiskers. But there's no Santa Claus, no mention of Christmas, nothing like that. And the trailer, which I put up on the Facebook page, you can find it on YouTube, is the weirdest trailer I've ever seen. It's 5 minutes long.
5 minutes.
And it's people walking around on the back lot of the studio saying, hey, have you seen that new movie Miracle on 34th Street? And Rex Harrison goes, oh, I love it. A great man's picture. They go to a woman and they say, I can't remember the name of the actress. Yeah. Have you seen? She's like, oh, it's a great woman's picture. Oh, it's a great comedy. Oh, it's a great drama. And nobody says what the movie is. And there's no footage from the film. It's totally bizarre.
Literally word of mouth. Literally word of mouth trailer.
Word of mouth trailer. They release it in the summer. Fortunately, it stays in the theater 6 months.
Wow.
So it ends up playing over Christmas time anyway, because it's that successful.
Did they adjust the marketing? Do you know?
I don't know.
I wonder.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so bizarre.
Yeah, it's really
cool. It's nominated for 4 Oscars, and it wins for Best Screenplay. And of course, very deservedly, Edmund Gwenn wins for playing Chris Kringle, because he's just great.
Really authentic.
Yeah. There were lots of remakes. There are 2 yes. TV remakes. Mm-hmm. There's the Richard Attenborough remake, which I think John Hughes wrote the script for. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those movies that was colorized, you know. But despite all the remakes, we just go back to the original.
Yeah, I was flipping channels the other day, and I stumbled upon the colorized version.
Hmm.
I didn't even think they still showed that.
People still like them. No, yeah. They still get released. Yeah.
I don't get it.
I don't either.
If they ever touch, who knows?
Yeah.
If they ever, didn't they try to colorize Kane?
There was talk of it, but I don't think anyone ever did.
I had to set the studio on fire.
Yeah.
That is an untouchable film, damn it. Anyway, yeah.
Well, yeah, of course. Well, to me, like, you can improve a film, but don't change it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, right. If you want to remaster Kane and make it, get a perfect, beautiful print, sure. Right. That's fine. Mm-hmm. But don't add color.
Yeah.
You know, this is what it is.
Yeah.
And it's funny, this becomes one of those movies that plays every year that people return to again and again. Mm. So what are your final thoughts on Miracle on 34th Street?
I would say it was great to finally watch it for the cinephiles. Like, it had been something that has been, you know, all of us as film lovers have like a ongoing organic mental list of movies that we have to get to at some point. And some of us who really love film, it's, you got to be in the mood for certain ones. And
oh, yeah.
I think kind of finding the right mood for this as we're into Christmas was the right time to watch it and be able to talk about it with someone like you who's seen it so many times and knows it so well. It was nice to be able to discuss the film from a different perspective. Like me only having seen it once and you having seen it so many times. It's nice to have that little back and forth about it. But I would say this is a very enjoyable film, very sweet film, and some really fantastic performances, which sometimes you don't always get in Christmas movies. These kind of like deeper, darker, more layered performances. Natalie Wood is incredible in this movie. Maureen O'Hara, just fantastic. And so to me, this is what is so enjoyable about the film and the message itself. Just that message about faith. When you don't even have to, or when you can, or when you shouldn't, or when you, a common sense tells you not to, having faith in something. I think that's what Christmas is all about. It's not about Santa delivering presents. It's having faith in mankind and what we talk about, that possibility that there is peace among men and women and the possibility of having a better future, a better existence. That's what we celebrate at Christmas. It isn't gifts or money or presents. It's about coming together as a family and as family, or coming together as friends, and like really cherishing that. And that is something that you have to have faith in will always be there, because it's what I think is what drives the world and what drives us as humans to exist in the world.
It's so funny, because I think if you were going to, you know, get teams together and you would put together team faith and team common sense, the odds are I'm going to be on team common sense. Mm. You know, I'm an atheist. Sure. I love science. I love logic. And yet, I'm really on team faith. And it's funny, the thing that keeps popping in my head, which is a weird thing, but is that Apple Computer ad in the Think Different campaign, which is the Here's to the Crazy Ones, which is one of the great ads of all time. And it shows all these images of these, you know, geniuses, Pablo Picasso and Gandhi and Albert Einstein. And, you know, it's kind of talks about, these are the people that didn't fit in. They're weird. They believed in strange things. And the last line is something like, maybe I'll just play it.
It is the people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones who do.
Now, that's a really profound line. And I think about the world that we live in, which, you know, feels like there's a lot of conflict and a lot of anger and a lot of people going, not trusting each other. Mm-hmm. And the thing that Fred says is that you have to have faith in me, have faith in your fellow man. Mm-hmm. Is that the idea of believing in Santa Claus is totally ridiculous.
Right.
We all know that isn't true. But the idea of kindness and compassion and trust of other people, if we don't have that, everything falls apart. Mm-hmm. even when all of common sense says I shouldn't trust anybody else, mm-hmm. you have to. Because if you don't, what do we have? We have nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. What's the point of life?
Yeah.
Honestly.
So that's what we think on Miracle on 34th Street. Of course, we always want to hear what you think. As always, you can reach us on our Facebook page at The Cinephiles, C-I-N-E-F-I-L-E-S. You can subscribe to us all sorts of places if you want to. On YouTube, on iTunes, on Stitcher, on TuneIn, on Spotify now. Please subscribe there. Leave comments on YouTube. Leave reviews on iTunes. If you want to support the podcast, you can do it on patreon.com/thecinephiles. You could suggest a movie there. We have lots of good conversation, extra audio things for you to listen to there. And as always, you could buy Miracle on 34th Street or any other movie we've ever talked about on our website, cinephiles.net. And as always, you can reach me on Twitter at SR Morris. John, where can they reach you?
Very well done, my friend. We're worldwide. We're worldwide. You can
subscribe
to us all over the yeah. place. So it's always great. Yeah, you guys can always reach me at The Roca Says on Twitter and on Instagram. And yeah, let me know what you thought about the movie and if you thought we really did a good job breaking it down or if we missed anything. It's always fun to have those discussions on Twitter.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we always miss some.
Well.
You got to. Yeah. And that's it for this week. We will see you next time on The Cinephiles.